Okay, so I am assuming the project has gone well or is close to completion. Several of you have sent emails and questions. I am assuming you have all gotten a response. I am around today if you have any last minute questions. And beyond the project, just a reminder that we have an exam coming up, midterm exam, next week. Okay. As I had mentioned earlier, only lectures 1 through 13 will be on the midterm. Okay, so the more recent material will be covered in the final, but you don't have to worry about it as far as the midterm is concerned. I will send out a sample solution a sample exam with potentially some solution shortly, just to give all of you a feel for what to expect. Okay. If you want, I can have some extra office hours on Friday if you have questions for the exam. I'm not here on Monday, so the day before the exam I cannot have any extra office hours, which I usually do. So Friday I can do that. If you have questions, you can come talk to me. Okay, Friday afternoon. If you want to stop by around 2 o'clock, I have some time at that point. Okay, and also he sent us via email. Okay, so with that, let's continue our discussion from last time. Remember that we were talking about fault tolerance. Okay, in particular, I introduced the notion of crash faults and Byzantine faults. Crash faults are one where the process either fails silently and just stops working, and or it is up and running and it's working correctly. Those are called crash faults. So the only kind of failure you can encounter are crashes. There are no bugs or no malfunctions in the process itself. And we also looked at Byzantine faults, where the process can fail in arbitrary ways. Sometimes it can function correctly, sometimes it can send garbage response, sometimes it can send no response. Okay? And we looked at how can you handle the problem of Byzantine faults. We used this notion of Byzantine general problem. Okay? The basic point was, to do this you need 2/3 majority. Okay, so you have multiple replicas. They are all processing the same request. Each request is sent to everyone. They all produce a response and you vote. Okay, and then in a vote you need 2/3 majority to prevail in order to isolate the Byzantine faulty process. That was the point. Okay, so to have k faults, you need 3k plus 1 processes. So now towards the end of this the class, I started talking about recovery. Yeah, recovery is what happens after a fault. So assume that a fault has actually occurred. Some processes have failed. After you restart them, what should happen? So there are multiple ways you can deal with recovery. So here is a technique that involves checkpointing. And this does not assume the presence of any replication. So it assumes that if you are, so the scenario is one of crash faults. Okay? So you assume that there is a distributed system with multiple processes, and some processes then can crash at any time. Okay? If you have no replication in the system, then when you restart the failed process, okay, if there is no state you can recover from, you have to roll back to the very beginning and restart everything. Okay? The point is, if you have a long running computation, how can you avoid that? So earlier in this course we talked about checkpointing the state of a computation. So we said if failures occur, then if you checkpoint state on disk, you can load that state, okay, restart all the processes, load that state and resume the computation from that point on, okay, rather than having to start from the very beginning. The example I had given was a distributed simulation, a long running simulation job, okay, which involves multiple processes. Any one process crashes while the simulation is running, you will lost that state. And then if you restart that process, if you haven't checkpointed intermediate state, you have to restart from scratch. Okay? So this allows you to, this basically goes back to the discussion on checkpointing. It says you can periodically checkpoint state. Upon a crash failure, you roll back to the previous checkpoint with a consistent state. Remember, we talked about this notion of a consistent snapshot, which allows you to resume the computation from a consistent state. So one way to do this is to just have each process checkpoint independently of other processes. Because each process, let's say, every 30 minutes, every 1 hour, it goes and it checkpoints the state. It does not coordinate with anyone. Okay? This is called independent checkpointing. Okay? Now, if some process crashes, then what you have to do is you have to go and look at all the checkpointed state of all the processes. If one crashes, you stop everyone. Okay? And then you go and look at all the checkpoints of each processes and find one that gives you a consistent cut. Okay? It's basically a consistent state, and you can start from that point on. It may so happen, because this is not a coordinated checkpoint mechanism, the latest checkpoint from all the processes is not a consistent cut. You may have messages that cross the boundary of a consistent cut and whatnot. Okay? Then you basically keep moving back. Okay? And potentially you have to go back to the very beginning if all checkpoints just happen to be inconsistent, okay, with respect to one another, then you have to go back to the very beginning. Okay? So the advantage of this technique is that each process can checkpoint independently, no coordination is required. Okay? But then at the recovery time, you have to do extra work to say which set of checkpoints is consistent, and you have to keep moving back in time until you find one that is consistent. So there may potentially a lot of wasted checkpoints that are not consistent. Yes, and you have to resume from some earlier point in time. So this is independent checkpoint. So alternative is, of course, to use this distributed snapshot algorithm, okay, that we had talked about a few classes back. Okay. This allows you to coordinate a checkpoint with all processes and ensure that is actually a consistent snapshot. Yeah, and then in this case, if some process crashes, you stop everyone and just load the most recent checkpoint, because it's guaranteed to be consistent. The checkpointing algorithm guarantees that. In the independent checkpointing, you are doing checkpointing independently. There are no guarantees. You have to check after the fact. Here you know ahead of time it's consistent. So just roll back to the latest snapshot and restart from there. Okay? This is one way to do recovery without having any replication. Okay? So here you can have processes crashing. Okay? Because there is no redundancy, things have to be restarted. But you use checkpointed state to do this. Now, all that said, checkpointing is still an expensive operation. Okay, checkpointing requires you to take the memory state of a process and write that out to disk. Okay, if you look at typical processes today, then memory state, which includes virtual memory, may be on the order of gigabytes. Okay, although you may have only maybe 4 GB of RAM, your processes can be of arbitrary size. Okay? And not the entire process does not need to be held in RAM. Some of it may be swapped out. Okay? So process sizes are large. To write this out frequently means you're basically taking several hundreds of megabytes or gigabytes of data and writing it out to disk. If you do this frequently, that's going to impact the performance of your application itself. Okay? So checkpointing, in other words, is expensive. Okay. And you don't want to do it frequently because it's expensive. So that gives you a gives rise to a trade-off. If you do infrequent checkpointing, then if there is any process failures, then you have to roll back to the previous checkpoint. All computations that have occurred since the previous checkpoint are lost. Okay. If you do frequent checkpointing, then you can recover to a state that is fairly close to where the failure occurred. But then you are paying higher overhead in terms of checkpointing. Okay. So the frequency of checkpointing it tells you what kind of penalty you pay. The frequency also allow, higher frequencies also allow you to start from a more recent checkpoint, okay, which is fair, so you don't waste computation. Okay. So the question is, can you somehow combine the advantages of the both of these approaches? And to do this, you have a hybrid approach which combines expensive checkpointing with something called message logging. Okay. So this only works for a certain class of application. This is not going to work for arbitrary processes. In particular, it will work for things like distributed simulations, where the computation of a process is solely governed by messages that are coming in and local state. Okay? So if that is the case, so there is no user input or no interactivity happening. Okay? So if this is the case, what you can do is you can actually checkpoint infrequently and then log all the messages since the previous checkpoint that have been received by this process. Okay. So then what happens is, if you restart from the previous checkpoint, you can simply replay all of the messages and have it quickly repeat that computation. Because the computation, as I said, is solely determined by local state and external messages that are coming in. There's nothing else that impacts the computation. No time or nothing, no user input, no interactive input. So if you do this, then you can actually log and replay those messages, and this allows you to catch up to exactly the point before the failure, okay, without having to pay the checkpoint over it. Okay, so you can combine these two techniques to reduce the overhead of checkpointing. So you can do that checkpointing operation infrequently, but then you log all the messages, so you do pay a price. But presumably writing a message to disk is significantly cheaper than writing a large amount of memory state to disk. Yeah, so you can try to get the best of both worlds if you do this. Okay. So that is checkpointing and message logging. Okay. Recovery oriented computation is yet another way to achieve or to deal with failures. I won't say you can tolerate failures, but this is another way to deal with failure. So the assumption here is that it is cheaper to optimize the system to recover quickly rather than designing the system to tolerate faults at all. Okay? So the assumption here is, okay, so systems are going to fail occasionally. If you can minimize the downtime to as small as possible, okay, the impact on end users will be minimized. So long as the application is willing to tolerate short downtimes, it may be cheaper to then use this method, which says recover quickly from any fault or anything like that, rather than having replication and all of these expensive schemes that have high overhead. Okay? So no replication. Don't assume there's any replication. Just recover as quickly as possible. So for a very, very simple example of this may be for your machine, desktop or a laptop. Okay, let's assume that occasionally things are going to hang or some software processes crash and whatnot. Okay? If you build a system to reboot very quickly, let's say you can reboot in a matter of seconds. Okay? This may be better than having some additional software layers in the OS that is trying to deal with process failures and crashes and so on, because that adds to the burden. And it doesn't yet completely solve the problem. I mean, no, OS level redundancy does not handle hardware redundancy. For instance, if something in the processor hangs, for instance, and a hard reboot is the only option. So what recovery oriented computing says is try to minimize the recovery time. Okay? So I already talked about the naive case of reboot, where you can make reboot as quickly as possible. So one other idea they had was do what is called micro reboot, which means rather than rebooting the whole kernel, which is all or nothing, you can reboot individual parts of the system. Okay, restart services independently of one another, or have a modular kernel where you can only reboot, let's say, the file system part of the kernel rather than just shutting the whole machine down and bringing it back up. Okay? This allows you to restart individual components, so the recovery time is even smaller. Okay, you can have sub-second recovery times by only restarting the parts of systems that are causing problems. Okay? This is a different take on fault tolerance. This basically the assumption here is the number of first observation is complex systems don't want to pay very high replication costs. Yeah, because like Byzantine cost, if you have 4x replication cost, the cost of a system, hardware, software is 4 times. Okay? Many systems just don't want to pay such a high cost. Okay? So what can you do with as little overhead as possible? And the one take on it is just design your systems to be modular so that you can recover quickly. Okay? Faults will occur, so you don't try to deal with them before, try to deal with them afterward. Okay? So this is an area of research that is still active. Okay? I think some of the ideas make sense for normal systems in any case where no replication is used, for instance. Okay? But they are trying to sort of go after more complex systems as well. Okay, so that's the last slide on fault tolerance. Okay, your question, yes.
So if it reboots, they don't have to redo all the computation. It's like restarting the checkpoint.
Right. So question is, if it reboots, does it restart all the computation? Here the recovery model is very loose. Okay? How you recover or whether some things may be lost is not told to you ahead of time. So if you are willing to tolerate some user requests that are lost or some user that are going to see an error, let's say it's a web server. Okay? You send a request, you get back an error saying server overloaded or connection failed or something, which happens frequently. Okay? So typical user response is try again or try again after a short time. Okay? So if you had a very fast recovery mechanism that allows you to either reboot the server itself or the machine in less than a second, okay, then the system starts working again. So this only works, as I said, for certain applications. Like if this was a database, this wouldn't work, right? If it's a banking database, you say I sent off a query saying transfer some money and I don't know what happened to it, whether it worked, the query executed or not, that doesn't work. Okay, so in that scenario, you want different semantics. But for many applications like web servers, people are more tolerant to errors. So in that case, don't pay the price of replicating the web server needlessly. Yeah, unless you need it for capacity reasons, but for availability reasons, let's not worry about it. Let's just make the system recovery very efficient. That's the point. Okay? So you will not recover all of the state because you are not doing anything to keep that state or log anything. Okay? Any other questions here? Okay. So next topic that we are going to look at is security in distributed systems. This is chapter 9 of the book. Okay, some of the material here is also taken from a networking textbook, but you don't really have to worry about that. Most of what I am covering here is actually in this book as well, although the examples may not match exactly. Okay. So I'll talk about, I'll give a quick introduction, but I will basically cover cryptography, authentication, and key exchange. Okay, we are really interested in distributed systems, so I'll show next time. Okay. Today I'll start with the basics. But next time I'll cover several examples of how distributed systems can use these ideas, okay, encryption protocols, authentication protocols, to in a secure fashion. Okay, so let's start with the basics today. We will look at several examples next time. Okay. So basically, scenario that we want to consider is again a distributed system. In the simplest case, the distributed system has two entities, A and B, and the system involves communication between A and B. Okay? And the idea is to make this communication secure. Okay? So, any intruder that can eavesdrop on this communication shouldn't be able to cause problems. And the problems is you can inject messages. So you can have any arbitrary things. You can remove messages and modify messages. You can insert messages. You can read and playback messages. So you need to be able to design your system to deal with all of these problems. Okay? And we will leave the entities A and B undefined. Okay? There could be a human and a system. Okay? There could be two processes within a distributed system. It doesn't matter what it is. Okay? They are just entities are communicating, and we want to ensure that the communication channel is secure. Okay? So let's try to look at this. To what you can do here. Okay? So the important issues for us are encryption or cryptography, which is the secrecy of the information being transmitted. We want to do authentication to ensure that parties that are communicating, okay, know that they are communicating with the real entity and not somebody who is an intruder who is trying to claim that he or she or they are someone else. Okay. Authorization, which is the authority to perform the requested action. Okay. If there are certain, if your system allows you to do operations at different levels of privileges, administrative operations and normal operations, you want to ensure that when somebody makes a request to do something, okay, they are authorized to do that. They have the right level of privileges.
Isn't that the same as authentication? If you know who they are, you know what actions they can do.
Okay. So the question is that the same of authentication is simply you prove who you are. Okay. So you can prove that, or I can prove that I am so and so. Okay. And subsequently, after I have authenticated myself, I say do this. Okay. System still has to check whether I have the rights to do it. Okay. They know who I am and they have to check that can I do this operation or not. Do I have access to modify the web page for the course. Okay, I may have authenticated myself. The system has to check. Okay? So that's orthogonal dimension. Okay, once you have authenticated yourself, you have certain rights or privileges in the system. So when you try certain operation, the system has to check whether you can do that. And you have to do this on a per action basis. Every time you do something, you have to check that. Okay? And the last thing is auditing. Okay? So you want to log all the actions and do post-facto analysis. This is also called forensics. Okay? So if something has gone wrong, okay, you want to go back after the fact and say, okay, how did this virus enter our environment? Okay? How did this machine get broken into? Okay? So you want to know all of this. Okay, so for this you need to have logs and you need to do analysis. Okay, that's also an area that is important. Okay, if you don't keep any information and something bad happens, there's no way for you to figure out why it happened and how can you prevent it from happening again. Okay, so in this class we will not talk about this. Okay, there's an entire course on forensics if you're interested. That's the course you should really look at. But we will talk about the first three. Okay, but keep in mind that this fourth thing, which is auditing or forensics, is also an important issue in security of distributed systems. Okay. So let's start with the very simple case of A and B. We'll call basically A, and in security terms we call them Alice and Bob. Okay. Doesn't matter whether Alice and Bob are people or machines or processes. Let's assume that it's a person and their machine. They're trying to log into your machine. Okay. Simple way you log into machine is you provide a username and password. Okay. And this goes over the network to the machine. Okay, you may be remote. You may be trying to log into a remote system. Okay. So your username, password goes over a network. And the clear problem is if this goes unencrypted, okay, then if there's an intruder who's sniffing packets on the network, they will get hold of your username and password. Okay, and then subsequently, they can log into that system with your username and password and steal information or do bad things. Okay. So this shouldn't happen. Yeah, so you shouldn't send username and password in plain text. Now it so happens that there are lots of systems today that are still not secure because they are using unencrypted text for communication. Okay? Router updates is a good example. ICMP messages, SNMP messages. Lot of these messages just go over a network unencrypted. Typically username, passwords, you use SSH or some secure protocol, so it deals with the security of your username and password, and we'll see how those things work. But there are many other systems that don't behave in this way yet. Okay? Router update is a good example. You can actually fake being some arbitrary router and send a routing update to some router in the network, okay, and cause all the packets to just go into the ether. The packets can get dropped. You can just tell a router that this link is broken, whereas it may not be. So it will think it does not have a path to certain machines and all packets get dropped. Eventually some of the packets will get routed through another path if the network is redundant. But you can cause problems like this. So the assumption in this case is the people who designed these routers assume that the routers are within an ISP backbone where you cannot have intruders coming and injecting messages. Need not be the case. It can happen. Same is true of SNMP messages. Pretty much any network device, okay, that you have in any large network, they could be access points or they could be routers or they could be switches. Okay. They are controlled using a protocol called SNMP, Simple Network Management Protocol. Lot of these SNMP protocols don't go over a secure channel. Okay. They may not even use authentication. Okay. Or if you use authentication, the password is left blank or some password may be set to password, something that is trivial to guess. Okay. So this can cause problems because you can log into an access point and shut it down if you could get hold of this SNMP port. Okay. So intruders that get onto a network can do arbitrarily bad things. Okay. Spam, you all know. Okay. This is basically you send junk messages pretending to be someone else. The reason for this is SMTP is still not secure and doesn't use full authentication. Okay, so it's easy for you to masquerade as someone else, send mail messages. Okay, and many mailers will just accept it without checking. Okay, so what can you do when you design a distributed system, okay, to prevent all of these problems? So users must clearly take a more active role. Application designers must think of security while they are building the application, not after the application is deployed and then you start seeing problems. Okay? That's too late and then you cannot make the right design decisions. Okay? So that's the background. So we'll start with encryption first, then we'll talk about authentication and the other bullets that we want to cover. Okay? So encryption, you probably know what encryption means. Okay? So it basically says you have a text message you're sending. Okay? You scramble the message and send what is called ciphertext, okay, over a network. Okay. And then at the other end, you take the ciphertext and you recover the original message back. Okay. right? This is basically a very simple idea. So here Alice and Bob, and that's basically the channel. So you have what's called an encryption algorithm. So any plain text message goes into the encryption algorithm. That's typically an encryption key that is used to encrypt or scramble this plain text message. You get what's called a ciphertext, okay, which is a new message where you apply the key to the plain text message. This is the thing that goes over the network and you decrypt it at the other end. Okay? Even in this case, you will assume that intruders can intercept your ciphertext. Okay? They can intercept plain text ciphertext pairs. Okay? And they can obtain either the what algorithm you are using. They may know you are using this algorithm to do encryption. Even if they do all of this, you still want to design encryption algorithm that cannot allow an intruder to decrypt your message. And we'll see several that will give you this property. We start with very simple ones. Okay, so here is a trivial encryption algorithm. It's a very simple substitution cipher. Okay. For each letter in the English alphabet, you have another letter that you have mapped onto it. Okay, it's a one-to-one mapping. Okay. So now you take any plain text message, you look up this key, and you replace each letter with its corresponding map. Okay, so this is basically a ciphertext. This is what you will send over the network if you use simple substitution cipher. This is the oldest form of encryption algorithm. This is what was used 2000 years ago, okay, by the Romans. Now, in this case, the key that you have, which is the mapping, there are 26 factorial keys, depending on how you, which permutation you use to map onto the English alphabet. Okay? So there are lots of keys. So on the one hand, you may think that that's almost 10 to the power 26 keys. It's unlikely that you will be able to guess it. Okay? But this kind of encryption algorithm is vulnerable to other types of attacks. In particular, you can observe the frequency of letters and try to guess certain mappings. Okay, so if you know E is the most common letter in the English alphabet, you can actually statistically analyze this string. Okay? You see which is the most frequently occurring letter here. Okay? And you know that E must be mapped onto that letter if E is indeed the most frequently occurring letter. So you can make guesses of this form and then actually try to decode. Okay? And if you have guessed certain letters of a word, you can guess the word and then you know what else is mapped on to certain letters. And then you can decrypt these messages in this fashion. Okay? So trivial algorithms like this will not work because they are vulnerable to these kinds of attacks. So here is another one, okay, that was in use for a very long time but is not used anymore today because today's technology allows you to do brute force attacks on this. Okay, so you can actually try to guess all keys and then try to figure out what's the right key. Okay, so this is called the data encryption standard or DES. It was a government mandated encryption algorithm at one point. I'll show you how this encryption algorithm works, but keep in mind it's no longer used. What is used now is what's called DES3, which is sort of this algorithm used three times in a row, or something called AES or Advanced Encryption Algorithm. So today's encryption, state-of-the-art encryption algorithms are basically AES based. Okay, but just to understand how you can build a better algorithm than the one we just looked at, let's look at this. Now, the thing to keep in mind is this algorithm uses what is called a symmetric key. Okay? So, to encrypt any message, you have to pick a key. Okay? And then to decrypt this message, you use the same key at the other end. Okay? So, if you apply the key to the message, you get a ciphertext. If you apply the same key back to the ciphertext, you will get back the original message. So, both the sender and the receiver have to have the same key. Yeah, so these are called symmetric encryption algorithm, which means there is a single key to do the encryption as well as the decryption. Yeah. So let's understand how to do this. So here what happens is you take arbitrary string, you chop it up into 64-bit chunks, okay, and then you apply DES on each 64-bit chunk and you get a ciphertext. Okay, and the way it does it is shown in this picture. So there are several rounds that you have to go through. So that's the initial 64-bit string, okay? And this is the final 64-bit string. So your message is chopped up into 64-bit strings and each 64-bit chunk goes through this process. Okay? So this is the key. So you have to pick a key. How we pick the key we will not talk about now, that we will talk about later. But assume that you picked a 56-bit key. Okay? So then what you do is from this 56-bit keys, you are going to generate 16 individual keys for this encryption. How to do this I'll show on the next slide. But let's assume so that can be just done by taking some subset of these 56 bit keys. Okay, so you can take arbitrary subset of these bits and generate for smaller keys. Okay, so this is what happens. You take the initial bit string, you do an initial permutation, and then you apply these keys in each round. Okay, there are 16 keys, so you encrypt this string 16 times with each key one at a time. Okay, in each round, this is essentially what's happening. So you take your 64 bit chunk, you chop it up into a left 32 bit and a right 32 bit. Okay, and then the right 32 bit is actually made the left 32 bits for the next round. And then you take this and this and you do an XOR with the key. Okay, so left half XOR, a function of the right half and the key. Okay, this is where the encryption is actually happening. Okay, so you repeat this in each round. Okay, this thing is basically repeated in each round. So there is a new key in each round. This is the key in the ith round. So encrypt the string 16 times. Okay, what comes out at the other end is the encrypted 64-bit string that you that basically is the encrypted version of the original message. So to understand how the keys are generated, so here is basically a way to generate a 48-bit key. Essentially, you rotate the string, do some left and right shifts, and you pick 48 bits for each round. Okay, so you take this 56-bit key, do initial permutation, you get 28 bits and 28 bits. So that's the 56 bits. That's the left half. You rotate it left. Okay, you rotate the bit string. You do a right rotate. Okay, and then you extract 24 bits. So this could be the most significant 24 bits here, most significant 24 bits there. You attach them together, you got 148 bits. And you repeat. Okay, you rotate it again, take the next 24 bits. Right. So you're basically picking different subsets of the bits from that 56 bits to generate 16 keys. Okay. There's your question.
So would this be more secure if instead of giving one 56-bit string, you gave all these 16 individual keys?
Would it be more secure if you, instead of one 56-bit key, you get all 16? The problem with the approach is that the key is not long enough. Okay, so you could have given me 16 48-bit keys. Okay, and the problem is how difficult is it for me to guess it. Okay, so if you wanted to do brute force attack, okay, the way you would do this is you would actually generate all possible 56-bit keys. Okay, because there are 2 to the power 56 keys that you can generate in a brute force. So you take each key and you try to decrypt the message. The algorithm is published. Okay, the DES algorithm is known. This is the algorithm. So it's a published algorithm. So I can take any encrypted message and I take all possible keys and try to decrypt and I see, does this message make sense? Okay. If I generate a message that I can actually read that text, I say, okay, this must be the key. Okay. So the problem is how expensive is it for me to launch a brute force attack? Okay. And this critically depends on the length of the key. Okay. If you have only if it's a 10-bit key, then you have to only try 2 to the power 10 possibilities. If it's 56-bit key, you have to try 2 to the power 56 possibilities. If it's a 128-bit key, you have to try 2 to the power 128. So it gets exponentially harder as the key size increases. Okay. And with today's hardware, it is no longer secure to use only 56 bits. That's the point. People have shown that you can break DES in a matter of minutes or tens of minutes on a small cluster of machines by launching a brute force attack. So that means that you use longer keys. So DES 3, it tries this 3 times in a row. Okay? So it uses 56 plus 56 plus 56 bits, around 168 bits, okay? Which is why it's harder to guess 3 56-bit keys. AES does 256-bit encryption. You need to now guess 2 to the power 56. Today's hardware, you cannot do that easily. Okay, so it's going to take you years to do a brute force attack on any modern hardware. So that's what encryption algorithms do. Okay, they basically have to keep ahead of what today's technology can allow you to do in terms of brute force attack. Okay, as technology improves, machines get faster and you have access to larger number of cheap machines, you have to use longer and longer keys. Yeah, that's the point. So guessing, providing those 16, 48-bit keys doesn't help because they're still 48 bits. That's the problem. They're not long enough to prevent brute force attacks.
So why does it XOR only half of it? Why does it XOR the whole thing?
Why does it XOR only up? It is basically in each round doing XORing the whole thing, right? It's taking this thing, the left and the right half, and it's applying the encryption function. Okay? Then it's getting, because it's a 48-bit key, you can't just take the whole thing. Okay? Because this is 64 bits, the key is 48 bits. So it's basically just doing it in rounds, for smaller strings at a time. So that's the... Any questions? I haven't actually proved to you that if I do this, repeat the same process again, you will get back the original message. Because I said it's a symmetric key. So you apply this, you take this encrypted string, you feed it as the input, you use the same key, repeat this process, what comes out should be the original message. Okay? That's the property of the algorithm. I just didn't show that that's the case. You just take it as a given.
Well,
in this
that's
case.
XOR, right? Like XOR, if you XOR something, XOR the same thing, you'll get back what you originally had.
That's true. That's sort of the intuition as to why that is the case. Okay? Okay. So, now that's the DES algorithm. There are many other symmetric encryption algorithms, but all of them have this one common problem, okay, that because the key is symmetric, there has to be a way by which the sender and the receiver agree on this key before secure communication can take place. Okay. Now, if you do not have a way to securely distribute keys, then you have orthogonal problem. You may be using a very secure encryption algorithm, but the key distribution is not secure. Somebody can intercept the key and eavesdrop on messages. So, one important principle in distributed systems is that an encryption algorithm is only as good as the mechanism that you use to distribute keys. Right. Your key distribution is not secure, your encryption algorithm doesn't work. It's like putting a large lock on your door and leaving the key somewhere. It's easy for a burglar to find. So the size of the lock doesn't matter in that case. If the key is accessible, the lock is useless. Right. Same thing is true here. Right. So you have to keep that in mind. We will talk about how to do key distribution. That's an important issue in any distributed system. Okay. So you need trusted ways to distribute keys. Okay. So here is the way typically this would work. There's a trusted agent that you have that both parties trust. Okay. That trusted agent generates that key, okay, for this communication channel and gets this key to A and B in a secure fashion. Okay. The important thing is to get that same key to A and B in a secure fashion. If that is not done securely, then things are not going to work because somebody else can get that key. So how to do this, we haven't seen. This is the basic principle of how you will generate a key and distribute it. But how to do this securely, we'll look at next time. Okay, so for now, we'll not worry about that.
Well, to do that means that the trusted agent has to send a secure channel, which means it must have given A and B a key, which means it must be another trusted agent that gave them a key.
Yes, so there are some levels of trust you'll have to go through before you solve this problem. Okay, so how to make that channel secure, etc., we'll look at. You can use another algorithm that we'll talk about called public key cryptography, which is an asymmetric key encryption algorithm to solve some of these problems. Okay, but we haven't addressed this, how to do this. Okay, we'll come back to it. Important problem to look at. Okay, but now what we'll talk about is an asymmetric encryption algorithm. Here, you do not have a single symmetric key. Okay, the previous algorithm and entire class of symmetric cryptographic algorithms or symmetric cryptography uses the same key. Okay. Here, you have two keys. One is called encryption key, another one is called a decryption key. As the name suggests, you use one key to do the encryption, use a different key to do the decryption. Okay? By using two keys, several things become simpler, as we will see in just a moment. Okay? So, there is a version of this called public key cryptography. Okay? Here what happens is, you take the encryption key and you make it public. You just publish it, saying if you want to communicate with me, use this key, encrypt your message and send it to me. Okay, so you make your public, you can publish it wherever you want, put it on your web page, hand it out freely to anyone who wants it. Okay? The decryption key, which is also called the private key, is assumed to be known only. That's the secret. That you never don't tell anyone. That you keep to yourself. Okay? So anyone can send you an encrypted message. Okay? because they know your encryption key. But because a decryption key is known only you can decrypt that message. That's the property that this algorithm gives you. Okay, so that's how it's going to work. So we'll talk about that in a moment. So what I just said is said here. So if you want, Alice wants to send a message to Bob, you take Bob's public key or encryption key and encrypt that message. And I said it's the Bob publishes his public key. Okay, you can get hold of it in some way and then you send that encrypt. Only Bob can decrypt this message. Anyone can get hold of this message, but just because you know Bob's encryption key and I have an encrypted message doesn't let me do anything. Okay? The property of the algorithm is you need to know the decryption key to extract the message back. Okay? And that is assumed to be secret and only known to Bob. Okay? So here you take the... Sorry?
You can replace the message
that
we want.
You can replace it with a new message. Because the encryption key is known, okay, I can intercept this message, change it and send it. Okay, this does not do authentication. Doesn't allow Bob to know that somebody sent that message, it was an altered in transit. To do that, we'll see there are other techniques. Okay, there is something called signing a message. Okay, but this is just a simple encryption. Okay. So the only thing you need in encryption is somebody shouldn't be able to decrypt it. Okay, so here is a very simple example of how these things work. There's an encryption key here, there's a decryption key here. Encryption key is made public, decryption key is secret. Any text message, you use the encryption key to make a cipher text which is visible to anyone but useless to everyone because you don't have the decryption key. Okay. Question is, how do you do this? Okay, so point is, knowing the encryption key and knowing the algorithm itself shouldn't allow you to guess the decryption key. Decryption key shouldn't be susceptible to a brute force attack. You shouldn't be able to generate all keys and somehow figure out which one the decryption key. So algorithm has to be secure from all of these types of attacks. Yeah. So the algorithm that is typically used to do this is called RSA. Yeah, it's named for the three letters there are the designers of this algorithm. Okay. Ron Revesh, Shamir and Alderman, RSA. That's sort of their initials. So this is the basic algorithm. It's based on number theory. Yeah, and the way you do this is, before you do this, you have to generate a public and private key. Okay? And then you give your public key to whoever wants to send a message. This is how you generate your public key and private keys. So you basically pick two prime numbers, P and Q. Okay? And these have to be large primes in order to prevent someone from guessing your key. So we'll assume that they are fairly large prime numbers, meaning bigger than 10 to the power 100, for instance. Okay? And then you compute the product of this prime numbers, P and Q, we'll call that product N. Compute another product Z, which is P minus 1 times Q minus 1. Okay? Simple arithmetic at this point. Okay? And then you have to choose a number D, which are no common factors with Z. Okay? D and Z have to be relatively prime. Yeah, I'll give you an example of how this works. Okay? And then you have to compute another number E such that E times D is 1 mod Z, which means E and D are also relatively prime. Okay? So at the end of this, what you have is you have basically N, which is the product of P and Q. You have E and you have D. So E and N is made public, D is kept secret. So together E and N are your public key. And D is your decryption key. Again, I'll show what this means in just a moment. Okay? And this is basically the encryption and decryption algorithm. Okay? So to encrypt any arbitrary message, you take this bit string B, okay? You take your message, you chop it up into smaller strings. These are bit strings. You take that bit string, you basically raise it to the power E and you do mod N. Yeah, this is an integer operation, because any string can be a bit string. So this is your encrypted message. To decrypt it, yeah, let's call this M. To do this, you basically just do M to the power D. Okay, which means you basically do this, and you get back the original message, okay, which is B. Okay, that's simply what RSA does at the very basic level. Okay, now, why is it secure? What does it do? We'll look at it in just a moment. So the reason it is hard to break RSA is that your number N is a product of P and Q. Okay? And factoring very large number into prime factors is a hard problem. Okay? Finding prime factors of very large integers is still computationally intractable. Okay? So if you have very large prime factors and then you take the product, I give you a very, very large integer and say find out all the prime factors, not a trivial thing. Okay, so that's the property you're going to exploit in RSA. If somebody addresses that problem, then RSA is going to be broken. Okay? Because if I give you N, it's going to be very hard for you to figure out P and Q or determine P and Q. In particular, it can take, I guess this is a little old now, so millions or billions of years if you take very large integers to start factoring them. Okay. So that's the property, and we'll now look at two things. First, we'll take an example of how you decide your public and private keys. For simplicity, we are just going to use very small integers. Okay. So I said start with two primes, P and Q. Okay, so let's pick P equals to 3, Q equals 11. Okay, two prime numbers. What's the product? 33. Okay, N is P times Q, so N is going to be 33. And then your Z is P minus 1 times Q minus 1. That is 2 times 10, which is 20. Okay, so now you have to choose D such that D and Z are relatively prime. So this is 20, so you pick 7. Okay, because 7 and 20 have no common factors. Okay. So that's your decryption key is 7. Okay. An encryption key E, so you have to pick E such that E times D is K times P minus 1, Q minus 1. Okay, because Z is P minus 1, Q minus 1. So let's assume K equals 1. So you have to pick E such that D equals to P minus 1 times Q minus 1 plus 1. That's 21. So E times D is 21. So that's 3. Okay, because 3 times 7 is 21. Okay. So encryption key. Decryption key is 7, encryption key E is 3, and N is 33. Okay. So now what does that mean? So what you have is N equals 33, decryption key is 7, and E is 3. So if you want to encrypt a particular string, you compute an integer, chop it up into bit strings, and then, as I said, you do that bit string to the power E mod n. Okay, so that means take any arbitrary bit string you do to the power 3, okay, mod 33. Okay, this is how your encryption process is going to work. Okay, so now you take a message, you chop it up into bit strings. For each bit string you apply this function and that gives you the encrypted version of that bit string. Okay, and then to decrypt it you take this and you do to the power 7. Okay, and that gives you back the original string. Okay. Now we can show. Sorry?
How do you know that going to the power of 7 gives back the original string?
Okay. So, question, how do you know that you get back the original string? So, that's basically a sort of a proof sketch here. Okay. As to how that works. So, this is based on a number theory result which says P to the power P minus 1 Q minus 1 mod PQ equals 1. Okay. This result we will assume. This is a known result in number theory. So, it says if there are two primes P and Q, okay, then you take any arbitrary number B, and if you do P minus 1 Q minus 1 and you do mod PQ of that, that gives you 1. Okay, this is number known result. Let's assume that for a moment. Okay, so what are we doing here in encryption? Okay, we are doing B to the power E mod N, right? So that is basically, let's start with mod PQ. So what we are essentially doing, we will ignore mod for now, okay, B to the power E to the power D. Okay, this is the encryption, and to do the decryption you raise it to the power D. Okay, at B to the power ED. Okay, what is ED? Okay, the way we chose it, okay, is basically this. That's how we chose it. That's how we were asked to choose it. Okay. So you substitute that equation, which is K times P minus 1 Q minus 1 plus 1. Okay. So what is this? This is B times B to the power P minus 1 Q minus 1 K times. Okay. Because it's K times this plus 1. So it's basically B times. Okay, so this basically, this means this whole quantity is repeated k times. Okay, so this, based on this number theory result, because there's a mod pq at both ends which I just ignored, so you substitute this by 1. Okay, Okay, that's the number theory result. So you basically get B times 1 time 1 time 1, that's B. So what we essentially shown is if you encrypt it and then you raise it to the power D, you are going to get back the original message based on that result. Okay? You cannot, if you want to do this, you can try it. Okay, like you can take this, what we just said. Okay, you take arbitrary number B to the power E was 3, do mod 33. Raise this to 7. Pick an arbitrary number. Let's pick 2. Okay? And you do this, you'll see that you actually pick any integer. You can actually try some example. You'll see you'll get the same thing. Okay? And the proof sketch is what I just showed. Any questions on this?
So 2 to the 3 is 8, mod 33 is still 8, so 7 is a very high number. How do you get back 2?
That you have to again do mod, yeah. Okay, so now here are some problems, because this is just, if you pick RSA as your encryption algorithm, right? So let's assume that your public key is known to someone. Okay, so there's a known value. So you are sending, Alice is sending Bob an encrypted message. Okay? Bob's public key is known. What could an intruder do? Intruder could intercept this message. Okay. So now here's a possible attack on RSA. Okay, what the intruder can do is intruder can take Bob's public key, okay, and take every possible, let's say you have 4-bit strings. Okay, I said you can take arbitrary strings and you can apply RSA. So you have 4-bit strings. So for each 4-bit strings, okay, I can use Bob's public key. Okay. And I encrypt it, so I'll get a different string. Okay, so I have this pre-computed tables for every possible string. Here is the encrypted version of that string using Bob's public key. Okay. So I keep this table, and now as these messages are going by, I intercept each message. Simply do a table lookup, saying if this is the encrypted text, what is the original text? And I recover that original text. Okay, so I don't know the decryption key. Okay, so decryption key is secret. All I've done is a brute force attack. Okay, rather than trying to guess the key, I said, here are all the possible strings. Okay, assuming there are 4-bit string, there are 16 of those. Okay, and I compute the encrypted version of those strings because public key is known. So I can take any string, anybody can encrypt using Bob's public key, because Bob has published it. So I have this table, original string, encrypted string using Bob's public key. And when messages go by, I simply intercept them, do table lookup, I recover the original message. Yeah, so I basically have broken RSA. If you do this. So what's the problem? How could you do this? Yes.
The problem is that you can put it on the table and pre-compute all that. You can make the table 2 bits pre-compute.
Yeah. So the issue here is the choice of BI, which was not specified in the algorithm. Okay. BI could be an arbitrary length string. If you choose BI to be too small, you can actually pre-compute a table of all strings and their encrypted pairs. So if you do that, then you can actually break RSA, because it's saying that you haven't actually chosen your parameter well. So the idea is, now when you have last message, you should pick long strings, BI, so that you cannot compute this table. Nobody can pre-compute this table. Okay? And the size of this table will grow exponentially as the size of BI grows. Right? So if this is an n-bit string, the table has 2 to the power n entries. Okay? If this is 4, it has only 16 entries. If it is 1024, it is 2 to the power 1024. If it is 2048, it is 2 to the power 2048. So the moral of this example is that you need to choose BI big enough so that no intruder can launch this kind of attack. Yeah, so your basically table has to be large enough that nobody can pre-compute this. If you choose BI to be small, then doesn't work. Even without guessing the decryption key, you can actually break it using a brute force attack. The point is, brute force attack shouldn't be easy to launch. Okay, here's one way to launch it. You don't choose BI to be large. Yes, question.
But this assumes you can break it into a chunk that's 1024 bits long or whatever. So what if your message is only like a very short message you want to send?
Yeah. If you want to send like a 3-byte message, then you have to either pad zeros or something to make it the minimum size message. Otherwise, you will have a problem. If you have 3-byte messages, then you only 2^8 different messages you can send. 3-bit messages, not 3-byte messages.
So if the intruder assumes you're sending a small message, you could just do the padding and say and figure out what you send.
But you don't tell the intruder what you pad. Right? I can say end of message and then pick arbitrary random string. If I just pad it with zeros, of course, that's problem. So I do end of message and I pick a random string, which basically means the intruder actually has to generate all of the entries in the table. It's not. It doesn't mean that all the other entries are bits are zero. Right. So that's the point. The point is that if you choose BI to be small, you are vulnerable to brute force attack. So you shouldn't do this. Okay? You should pick BI to be large enough. Here's another problem with RSA. Okay? This has to do with key distribution. So here's an intruder that's sitting between Alice and Bob. Okay? So before Alice starts sending message to Bob, Alice has to get Bob's public key. Right? Bob has published the public key. Let's assume Bob puts it up on his homepage. Okay, so here is my public key. Okay? So intruder can go hack into the web server and change Bob's public key. Okay, so Alice can get hold of the wrong public key. In particular, the intruder can replace Bob's public key on the web page with his or her own key, public key. Okay? You really don't have to hack the web page, but assume that you actually send a request to the HTTP server. The HTML page is coming over the network. You can capture this HTML page and modify the key that is in there, and somebody will go to get the wrong key. Okay? So now what happens? Now Alice actually has the intruder's public key, not Bob's public key. Alice thinks it's the Bob's public key. So Alice goes and encrypts a message, sends it to Bob. Okay? That message gets intercepted by the intruder. Okay? Intruder knows the private key, okay? Because they actually gave their own public key. So you decrypt the message. Okay? Now you re-encrypt it with Bob's real public key and send the message to Bob. Okay? So the intruder is transparently sitting between Alice and Bob, taking every message that comes from Alice, decrypt it, so you know the message content, re-encrypt it with the real public key and send it. As far as Bob is concerned, there are messages coming over the wire. They are decrypted with Bob's public key and they are encrypted with Bob's public key, so you can decrypt them. So Bob doesn't think there's anything wrong. Okay? And Alice seems to send messages and Bob seems to be getting them. Okay? There's this intruder sitting in between transparently, intercepting every message, decoding it, re-encrypting it and sending it. This is called man in the middle attack. So you have this person in between that is basically causing this problem. Okay, now why does this problem arise? This has nothing to do with the RSA itself. Okay, this goes back to the key distribution problem. Yes?
This is authentication. You have to make sure the key you got was really B's public key.
Right. So this is what I was saying even for the symmetric key cryptography. This encryption algorithm is only as secure as key distribution. Your key distribution is not secure. In this case, you published it on your web page. But there's no way for you to ensure that somebody accessing the web page actually gets the right version of the key. Okay? The contents of this page, when it goes over HTTP or the network, can get modified. Somebody can hack into the web server and change the key and then change it back. You don't know. So if you don't have a secure way of publishing your key, okay, somebody can replace your key with something else and do this kind of attack. It's called man in the middle attack. Okay. So again, the problem here goes back to secure key distribution. If the key was distributed securely, Alice would not have gotten the wrong key. Alice would have actually gotten Bob's key, and this you couldn't have had this problem. Because of this inability to distribute this in a secure fashion, you have this issue. Yeah, the intruder pretending to be Bob to Alice and pretending to be Alice to Bob. And you have this problem. Okay, next time we'll talk about secure key distribution. This brings back to the principle saying all of these only work so long as you can distribute keys securely. Okay, otherwise you cannot you will have this problem. Any other questions here? Okay, so I wanted to leave 5-10 minutes for questions regarding the project. Yeah, but I don't know if you have questions. I thought I'll leave a little bit of time last. Today is the last day, I presume, right? Is everything going well? Are there any issues that have cropped up? Who has finished? Okay, some subset of people have finished. Okay, yes, question.
So we create a lot of threads in the client. We have a class and we create a lot of remote requests using threads.
Okay.
Each remote request is going in a new thread. So there we check for the write log. In case of a post message is coming in, we check if the write log is already obtained. In case of the write log is obtained, we make a thread wait. So any subsequent requests that are coming in are going to wait. So how about the ordering? And then when the log is getting released, we just do a notify.
Yep.
So any random thread, this is the wait state will be broken up, right? So ordering,
yep.
Are we
going to
take care of?
Ordering of read and write request, or ordering of what?
Ordering on the wait, threads in the wait state.
Yeah.
So if we give a notify after the write log is released, any one thread in the wait state will be broken up and it will get the log.
Yeah. So you could assume FIFO ordering or you could assume some other ordering. So long as you can ensure fairness or at least discuss what your implementation does. The right thing to do if you wanted to be fair is to have FIFO. Okay, so when our requests make a, not request, threads make a request for logs, you queue them in that order and you notify them in that order. Okay. That requires extra work. If you do something like notify all where every sleeping thread is woken up, everything that's blocked is woken up, the content and somebody wins, you don't know who wins, that's a randomized strategy. It may not guarantee fairness, but it won't have arbitrarily bad behavior. Okay? But you should document that. I mean that you are not using FIFO for log acquisition. The FIFO would have to actually make you only wake up the thread that was blocked first and made the first request and got blocked, not everyone. Okay, so that's we didn't specify that you have to do it one way or another. All I'm pointing out is if you do it in a certain way, explain what that is, explain what might be the limitations of it. So long as you can justify your thing and explain the advantages, disadvantages, it's fine. Okay, because it doesn't violate anything we have said here. Any other questions? Has anyone implemented read-write locks FIFO fashion? So you did FIFO. Somebody tried, didn't work?
Yes. It's a work in progress.
Work in progress.
I did it in a different way because I thought it'd be better. I basically say if there's no write lock taken, even if a read lock comes in and there's a write lock waiting, they can take that lock, which has problems because the write lock.
Then you have starvation, yeah. So you could, of course, do what was just said, but once a writer is waiting, right, a really fair implementation would then actually block for the readers, just let all the readers to completion, let the writer goes, then the whole batch of reader goes. Okay? Because if a writer is waiting and there's a continuous arrival of readers, then the writer can get starved. Okay? But that's okay, we didn't specify. You should just say this is what you did, this is the advantage of doing this, this might be a drawback of doing this. You could just let them contend randomly, you could let them contend in this fashion, you could do pure FIFO, any of those are acceptable. But what we want is for you to know what design decision you made, what does that mean for fairness of your implementation. So long as you can argue that, at least you understand what you have done. That's the more important part. Any other questions? The clock synchronization is fine.
Another thing is for the timestamp, how do we do our clock synchronization?
In the application itself, how do you stamp timestamp?
Yeah,
That is a design decision. That's you can you pick the real time stamp or you can pick something else.
It would be difficult to use it to send it during the retrieve.
It would be difficult to send during the retrieve. Why?
The current system time. It is going to store the current system time as a timestamp. So for a retrieve message, the user will have to specify a timestamp time.
Yeah.
So
what's the problem? Why can you not specify it?
Okay.
I mean, your clock synchronization does is you have a wrapper get time function, okay, that actually gets the system time. It takes a clock offset, your synchronization algorithm has computed, it adds it, so it corrects the system time and sends it back. Okay, so you run the algorithm, you don't actually change the system time, you just compute this offset. Every time your application asks for system time, you apply it. That's all the clock synchronization has to do. Okay. Beyond this, the rest of the time stamping is same as what you did in the first project. That part has not changed at all. So just use whatever you did there. Only thing you are doing here is that because there are multiple clocks, just synchronizing them. That's all. In the previous case, they were not synchronized. Okay? Any other questions, comments on this? Okay, so I have, let me stop here, but don't leave. I have to give out the homework.